It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. State lawmakers in more than a dozen states have introduced 29 bills that aim to restrict colleges' efforts at improving diversity, equity, and inclusion. That is the latest from the Chronicle of Higher Education's DEI legislation tracker. Call in with questions and reactions to anti-DEI bills, what it means for Wisconsin, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Adrienne Liu is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, where she focuses on underrepresented students. Adrienne, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Morning, Kate. How are you?
I'm doing well. So you are part of this team at the Chronicle tracking this legislation around the country that is looking to curtail DEI programs. Why did the Chronicle start this project and dig into this?
Yeah, so we've seen higher education come under criticism by political conservatives around the country for several years now. And back in January, the Goldwater and Manhattan Institutes released model state legislation that would address four specific areas of diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts at public colleges and universities. So we were curious to see how many of these efforts would actually end up in bills in state houses. And to see how many actually end up in law. So we decided to track them, you know, across the country.
And so you mentioned the Manhattan Institute, the Goldwater Institute. These are think tanks. They've created this model legislation. What are these proposals like? What are they trying to get state legislatures to do to rein in DEI?
Yeah, so the Manhattan Goldwater Institute say what they're trying to do is to quote unquote dismantle the DEI bureaucracy, and those are that's their terms for it. But they're looking at four specific strategies that colleges have used to try to improve diversity, equity, and inclusion. So the first is just having DEI offices or staff or programming. So the legislation would seek to ban, you know, having offices or staff to improve these goals. Another is to ban mandatory diversity training. Another aspect would prohibit the use of diversity statements in either hiring or admissions at colleges. And finally, the last piece would ban the use of identity characteristics such as race or sex in either admissions or hiring or promotions.
On the other side of this, what have colleges and universities been doing in recent years to advance diversity, equity, and inclusion?
Yeah, so for many years now, colleges have been trying to work to improve diversity, equity, and inclusion, and that has, you know, only ramped up since the murder of George Floyd in 2020. So what that means is that they've done things like hired administrators and staff dedicated to these goals. They've adopted strategic plans, and they've included DEI efforts in their mission statements. So more specifically, and DEI efforts can include a really broad range of efforts by colleges, but they can include things like culturally relevant programs or centers. It can mean using data to try to analyze challenges to retention and completion for underrepresented minority students. It can include something like professional development for faculty to help them understand the experiences of diverse students.
Mm. I'm going to reintroduce you, Adrienne Liu here, senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, as we talk about DEI programs and model legislation coming from two think tanks. The Chronicle following this legislation around the country. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Adrienne, you know, you did bring up these diversity statements, and it wasn't until I read your pieces did I really start to understand what are diversity statements. And I was wondering if you could kind of explain these and why they've become so contentious.
Yeah, so diversity statements are when colleges ask applicants who are, you know, seeking to join faculty or staff to explain how they have contributed to these types of goals toward diversity and equity and inclusion. And they've become pretty controversial because some critics say that they, you know, cross the line from, you know, helping to ensure that all students feel welcome on campus, for example, to enforcing a single ideology, and that they, you know, the critics argue that diversity statements can be a way of ensuring that only certain political views are welcome on campus.
So, you know, they are, the question would be, is are they a true gauge to measure or predict a job candidate's true commitment to DEI work? And with the dismantling of these statements, that may go away. We might not know.
Yeah, that's right. And the critics of the critics would argue that by restricting applicants from talking about their experiences, for example, helping diverse students, or restricting colleges from asking about that, that is another form of restricting free speech. So you have sort of the same argument on both sides of the issue.
Have states become more likely to glom on to this model legislation that's being drafted here? And, you know, as we all have on our minds, what about Wisconsin?
Yes, so far we've seen 17 states introduce bills touching on these four aspects of diversity, equity, and inclusion. We've not seen any in Wisconsin yet, but we're certainly watching to see if that happens.
Let's take a call now. Jack joining us from Madison. Jack, hi, go ahead.
Good morning. So I guess given the bit of the conversation I've heard so far, you know, I've been hearing a lot about initiatives to, you know, bring students of more diverse backgrounds to colleges and universities, and I commend all that. But then looking at, like, the crackdowns that I guess Republican politicians seem to be engaging in or looking towards in various states, I'm curious as to how much of this is just them playing politics and kind of, if you will, saber rattling with, you know, this notion of diversity, equity, inclusion, and, like, you know, kind of ranting about students, you know, from more marginalized backgrounds being able to go to school. And they're just doing this, you know, like, to play politics and kind of push their, I guess, perverse agenda, but then getting around that, how can we actually create a more welcoming environment for students of, you know, more diverse backgrounds to, you know, go to school and have a good education or be accepted to college?
Jack, thank you. And I want to toss this over to Adrienne. Go ahead.
I'm trying to remember if there was a question.
Well,
in there.
And wondering whether this legislation that is popping up around the country, is this just an example of saber rattling, as Jack said, or can it really go somewhere? And then the second part piece of that is, how do you do DEI work right? Or is there a right way? How can you make campuses more inclusive in the environment that America is in right now?
So for the first piece, I would say that yes, even though at this point none of these bills have been signed into law, we've already seen a real impact in some states. Missouri, the University of Missouri system, for example, went ahead and decided to stop the use of diversity statements, even though that, you know, as I said, the bill hasn't been signed into law. And we've seen that in a couple of other states, Iowa and Texas. We've seen some, you know, some actions even ahead of bills being signed into law.
Can the universities that you have seen efforts, you know, to do DEI and to hire DEI officers, how have efforts by universities to improve equity and diversity, have they had any effect?
Yeah, that's a really important question and a really complex question. It's really hard to talk about DEI efforts as a whole because they encompass so many different things. And so you really have to break down into different pieces. And, you know, the evidence is probably pretty mixed. I would say that based on the continuing achievement gaps that we see between white students and underrepresented students, and as well as, you know, problems that colleges have had recruiting and retaining diverse faculty, that there's still a lot of work to do.
Chronicle of Higher Education journalist Adrienne Liu with us, part of a project tracking where college diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts are under attack by state legislatures, model legislation. Call in with your questions about the scope of these bills, your experiences with DEI in the college setting. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss diversity, equity, and inclusion in higher ed and legislation afoot in some states to stifle DEI initiatives. The Chronicle of Higher Education tracking bills that seek to dismantle the way colleges recruit and retain students of color. Join in with your questions and comments about the future of DEI. 800-642-1234. Adrienne Liu is here, senior reporter at The Chronicle, and stays with us. Let's go to Pete in Eau Claire. Pete, hi.
Hello. One basic human need is a feeling or a need to belong, to a group or whatever. I'm just curious, how does promoting diversity create unity?
How does promoting diversity create a sense of unity? Adrienne, have you pursued that question in your reporting?
I think a lot of diversity, equity, and inclusion offices would have as one of their goals to help all students feel a sense of belonging on campus. And I do want to note that DEI offices are not aimed solely at students, underrepresented students, meaning minority students. It can also mean making college more accessible and welcoming to, for example, students with disabilities or first generation students, or LGBTQ plus students. So it's not just students by race that DEI offices are trying to help.
You mentioned University of Missouri recently doing away with its statements committing to diversity in favor of more generic values, a more generic value statement. Why did the university take this step?
So the University of Missouri system said that they officially were not using diversity statements, but that they found some inconsistencies, and so they just wanted to make sure that that it was clear across the system that diversity statements should not be used.
Do you think it was in response to legislation there?
It certainly came after legislation was introduced. So
are there states that are taking the crackdown on DEI initiatives even further? What are you seeing in Florida, for instance?
Yeah, so there have been a couple of states that have introduced bills that are really even go beyond the model legislation. In Florida, for example, House Bill 99 would shift more power to over faculty hiring and tenure over to trustees. It would also ban majors and minors in critical race theory, gender studies, and intersectionality, which, you know, goes beyond what was seen in the model legislation. And Ohio also has a bill that's pretty broad ranging, Senate Bill 83. The bill is 39 pages long. And in addition to banning many different kinds of diversity initiatives, it would require annual faculty performance reviews, require colleges to post their course syllabi online, would require students to pass an American history or American government class to graduate, and it could bar Chinese students from enrolling.
You mentioned 39 pages long, all relating to, what colleges are doing. I'm wondering, does this relate to both public and private? What is the distinctions there?
Yeah, Ohio's bill in particular would subject some private colleges that receive state funds to some of these provisions, most of the bills we're seeing across the country would apply just to public colleges and universities. But there are a few states, including Ohio's, that would apply to any institution receiving any state funding, which includes some private colleges.
Adrienne Liu with a senior reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education as we talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and legislation in some states. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Julie is here from Madison. Julie, hi.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm wondering, I'm supportive of diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. However, the curriculum in general continues, and I am white, continues to be very vanilla and European American. I'm wondering if the reporter could comment on, what seems to be left out, and that this seems to be a restriction of freedom of speech to not allow diversity to be discussed. And I guess I'm hoping maybe it's a second topic more quickly that the curriculum would be more inclusive of all history that has been very much left out and made vanilla or white.
Julie, thank you. And Adrienne, what do these bills mean in regards to curriculum?
So most of the bills really don't say anything about curriculum. The bills that I just mentioned in Florida and Ohio are sort of exceptions, and they do talk a little bit more about what colleges can and can't teach. But the majority of the bills that we've seen really don't get into the curriculum aspect.
I wonder what impact could the pending Supreme Court cases regarding race conscious admissions at Harvard and at UNC, what impact could that have on the state legislation you're seeing around the country?
Yeah, certainly the Supreme Court is expected to rule very soon on race conscious admissions. And that would, that would mean that, this piece in the model legislation dealing with identity characteristics would not be necessary, because it would be sort of talking about that already in admissions. I guess if you're talking about hiring and recruiting faculty, that piece could still be relevant. But you're right. If the Supreme Court rules regarding race conscious admissions, that would probably mean that piece of the legislation would not have any particular impact on student admissions.
Looking in the months to come, perhaps years to come, if these measures do become law, have you thought about how do you see them affecting the educational experience in these states?
Yeah, that's a good question. One indication, there was a survey released last week by a higher education consulting group, the Art and Science Group, and they surveyed high school students, and they found that 1 in 4 students had ruled out colleges due to the politics or policies in those particular states. Hmm. So that says to me that these are issues that high school students really care about, and that they could have a potential impact on who attends college in any particular state.
Are there any states that are attempting to do the reverse, to expand diversity and inclusion efforts?
Yeah, we have seen bills going in the other direction in a couple of states. In New Jersey, for example, there's a bill that would require public colleges to develop faculty and student diversity plans with specific goals for increasing recruitment and retention of diverse faculty and staff. So that's just one example that we've seen.
Adrienne, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Adrienne Liu is a senior reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education, focused on underrepresented students. We have a link to the Chronicle's DEI legislation tracker. It's at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. They are sisters and UW-Madison alums helping homeowners rebuild after disaster strikes. They renovate homes struck by fires, floods, other unexpected catastrophes. Call in with your questions for the co-stars of the new HGTV series, Renovation 911. The number to call in is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lindsay Brinkman-Uzelding co-owns the Minneapolis design and construction firm Practical Home. Lindsay, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having us.
And Kirsten Brinkman-Meehan is co-owner of the firm, and together they star in HGTV's Renovation 911, which premiered recently. Kirsten, welcome to you as well.
Oh, thank you so much. So fun to be here.
Well, Kirsten, let's give us a taste of your origin story. How did you and Lindsay get into this business?
Yeah, so our dad has been in the construction industry since long before we were born. So we were kind of born into it, and we've been going to construction sites with our dad for our entire lives. He was the first employee of Ungerman Construction. And he taught us, you know, everything he knew because we kind of followed him wherever he went. Back in the day when you had beepers and he would get a beep and off we'd go to a site and assess an emergency together. So,
Lindsay, did you have any trepidation at all going to work for a family business instead of, you know, following your own path?
After graduating from UW-Madison, I went into corporate America. I never thought that I would be involved in the family business, to be honest. High school, college, and even early in my career, I went and worked with Target Corporation out of college, went to, you know, the interviews at Granger Hall and got my first job at a Minneapolis-based company that was one of my dreams. So after about 12 years, my dad had an opening in the family business and said, would you ever consider coming over to small business? And I was like, let me think about that. And so many, you know, conversations and pros and cons list later, I took the leap of faith and came over to the family business.
Oh, what a story. And Kirsten, turning to the business now, what are some of the craziest mishaps or disasters you've seen happen to a home?
Yeah, so I've been working for my dad in some capacity through high school and college summers, and then I went full-time with him right after graduating from Madison. So I have been involved in quite a few disasters, to say the least. I'm not sure if anyone tuned into our first episode, but there
yes.
was a high-speed chase and a car went through the front of a house and landed in the living room of a home. That was just something you don't see every day. And another really fun one, not fun, but funny, I should say, is a gal had called my dad about 4:45 p.m. one night. And she had ran her car through the backside of her garage. And she was very nervous, having, you know, kind of a panic attack. And she's like, could you get here and fix this by 5 o'clock when my husband gets home? And my dad's like, I don't think I can do that. So it's kind of, fires, floods, basements with floating washers and dryers in the, you know, in the flood. It's hard to even put into words all that we've seen through the years.
And it's remarkable to me, Lindsay, that when you two arrive on site, it's looking pretty bad. And so as I was watching, I was really worried about you as you entered these structures and whether they were sound to even go into. Does that cross your mind about the stability after these floods and fires?
Yeah, it's always the first thing we do is make sure that the environment is safe. So that is, you know, a really good observation. It's definitely our team is the first one to get there. A lot of times before Kirsten and I get there, we have different, you know, credentials and licenses and certifications for this type of work. So, you know, if we're going into a major water damage, our team definitely goes through the entire structure to make sure that it is sound, or we'll have, you know, a carpenter there to, we call it, shore up a wall, so that it is safe to go into some of these buildings, especially, you know, when it's been a vehicle damage or a fire damage. A lot of times the structure can get compromised. So that is definitely something that's always top of mind for us and our team, that we're not putting anybody in harm's way.
You also are the person who talks to the family first. And I'm just wondering if you could give us some insight into what those conversations are like in these really horrible moments, unexpected, you know, catastrophes.
Our clients really have situations happen to them that they're not expecting. And that's really the difference with our show. You know, a lot of times when you have a remodel, you plan and prepare, you save. And in our situation with construction, we have a unique, you know, niche of it's emergency. So when our clients call, they're in distress. So we almost play therapist to try to help calm them down and just reassure them that we're going to help them. I mean, that's what we do. We've been doing this for decades, and we know this business fairly well. And it's really, you know, they're putting us in their hands to get them through this event that they've had in their home. And our homes are pretty special places to us, right?
Mm, yes.
We invest a lot of money in them. You know, we care, you know, we try to take care of them the best we can. We take a lot of pride in where we live. So we want to show the same care and empathy to our clients to get through these situations and ultimately make the home, you know, one of the best homes that they could even imagine by the end of it.
And it sounds like you're helping put them in good hands. But Kristen, especially when you're in like a crisis mode, it's really not a good state to be in to make decisions. And so how does that homeowner choose like a damage restoration company or choose a contractor in that really stress-filled time that things are happening all at once?
Absolutely. It's incredibly stressful. And the best recommendation that Lindsay and I can tell anyone out there is when you have a fire or a insurance claim that, you know, where your home is badly damaged, go with a restoration contractor who works in this industry. There are so many nuances related to our job sites that a typical remodeler just doesn't know. So, you know, there's so much odor related with a fire damage. And so if you don't know how to, you know, eliminate that odor, you're going to have homeowners moving back into a house that still smells like that fire. And they're going to have memories of that fire, even when they're back in their home. So I would recommend just really going with a contractor that you have great rapport with, you have a great conversation with. We love walking our clients through the process. Like, that's huge, because that first day they are anything but, you know, sure of the next step. Mm-hmm. So if we can take it step by step for them, walk them through how it's going to go, it usually does calm them down. 'Cause at first you can only see the destruction, but once we start to show them, like, we're going to get everything approved and written, and then we're going to, you know, clear it all out. And then we're going to start picking out all the beautiful items, and then we're going to start putting it back together. So you just really need a contractor that you feel comfortable with, because you're getting into a very long-term relationship with that contractor. 'Cause these projects take a very long time.
Lindsay, what comes up for you navigating those first steps that people need to take after a major accident at the home?
I mean, the most important thing we do right away is just reassure them that it's going to be okay and that we're going to get through this. Empathy is really important. And so just reassuring them, I agree, you know, Kirsten and I, and ultimately our dad had that motto, is that the contractor that you pick during, you know, this event in your home is so important. You have to trust them. And so that's my biggest thing, is building trust. And if we don't have trust right away in the beginning, it's not going to be a good fit. And that's, we just have to be honest with the clients and us, because that's what's going to carry us through the rest of the project, is that trust. So that has been really kind of our principles, is building that trust in the beginning. If we have it, we continue to move forward. And then ultimately quality work, producing really good quality job sites is very important to us. And making sure that we're in the insurance world, the client gets like for like. So if you had granite countertops, you get and they're ruined, you get compensated for granite countertops, not high-end quartz. You know, it's just, it's like for like. Mm-hmm. And that's the most important thing that I try to tell our clients, is like, you're not going to get something completely different and all these upgrades. The upgrades are really up to the client if they want to pay for an upgrade. We are here to put the house back how it was. And if the clients want to take advantage of the opportunity to do some upgrades, then let's do it. You know, we're ready for the challenge. So for me, it's just really making sure that we're settling the claim and that we're understanding what, or if there's any upgrades our clients want to do above and beyond the insurance portion. And then really Kirsten gets them to the point where they've kind of accepted that, okay, this happened, we can do this, and then she takes it from there.
Lindsay Yezelding and Kirsten Meehan, they're sisters, emergency home restoration experts. Call in with your questions about property disasters. Bring a story about what happened to your home, how you rebuilt. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. They are UW-Madison grads. They are co-stars of the new HGTV series called Restoration 911. And we learn about house emergencies, what to do when disaster strikes. Still time to pose questions to the emergency home restoration experts, 800-642-1234. Lindsay Brinkman-Yezelding and Kirsten Brinkman-Meehan, stay with us. Kirsten, picking up on what Lindsay was saying on the like for like, and when a disaster strikes, you know, perhaps being able to do an upgrade on a particular aspect of the restoration work. How can homeowners make the most of that type of situation? Where should they do the additional work, the additional upgrades?
Yeah, you know, that varies for every customer, but I will say, in every job that we do, there becomes this silver lining for people. So, you know, a lot of people have always hated a wall that separates their kitchen from their dining room. So they have an option to put in some extra money into this, you know, repair, and they can take a wall out, you know, and open up a space. We do that quite often. A lot of times people are thinking about, you know, upgrading to a tile bathroom. Well, they have a giant water damage. The floor was ripped out. Now's the time to change from the vinyl, the sheet vinyl, to a beautiful, you know, marble tile. It's up to them if they want to put those funds in. Otherwise, we just put the vinyl sheet tile back in. But what's really cool these days is there's so many options for that like for like. So insurance dictates the, you know, allowances that you have. And so we can find really beautiful stuff within lots of different allowances. So it's, yeah, it's a great time for people to go to upgrade because your house is already torn apart. Your house, it's already in disarray. A lot of times you're already moved out, but a lot of times we can just put it back together even more beautiful using the same allowances without putting any funds, additional funds in.
And going along the theme of flooding in that first episode, you know, we see you work on that home that flooded because of just like a cracked rubber hose connected to a washing machine and holding it up there to the camera. Lindsay, what simple forms of maintenance can we do to prevent catastrophes like that from happening?
Yes, all of our clients, you know, after they've kind of accepted that this emergency happened, a lot of times the first question they ask is there anything I could have done to prevent this? And that is where Kirsten and I recently started a new business called Practical Home. Practical Home is all about prevention, tips, and design for your house. So with that hose, I mean, washers actually create a lot of damage. So not only the hose, check that. It should be replaced every 3 to 5 years. That connects the water from the washing machine to the, you know, to the supply. The other piece of the washer is there is a filter. And a lot of times that gets clogged and the washing machine overflows, hence another water damage. And so just those simple things, toilets, drains, there's so many things. If you have water pooling up in your shower and it's, you know, kind of building up to your ankles, use a hair snake. Try to get some of the, you know, that stuff out of your drain. We don't recommend Drano, but we do recommend getting the drain out or getting the clog out of the drain by actually getting the items out of it. So, you know, this just these little tips can really help prevent a lot of these disasters that we respond to every day.
Kirsten, when you've had some flood damage in your home, are there tips to deal with the water damage and trying to stop the mold and stop the mildew really fast?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you do have a water loss in your home, a lot of people instantly get worried that mold is going to start growing. So just be rest assured that mold doesn't start to grow until about 72 hours after it's been saturated. So as long as you are able to stop, you know, the water from leaking, and let's just say it's a basement with carpet and pad, we automatically recommend like pull your carpet back, pull your pad back, stop the water from coming in. And if mold doesn't have food, which is water, it can't grow. So, you know, we are a restoration contractor and we come in and we do all the tear out and the dry out. And that's just a very large part of our business, but it is very easy to dry out a structure long before mold ever starts to grow.
Kirsten Brinkman-Meehan with Lindsay Brinkman-Uzelding. They are co-stars of the new HGTV show Renovation 911. You can call in with questions about home repair after catastrophe strikes, 800-642-1234. Lindsay, how difficult can the insurance adjusters be to work with when trying to repair a home? You do a lot of that back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the beauty of our business. This is what we do. So this really, all we know, we've worked with insurance companies for over, you know, 47 years. And so, the important thing for us is, you know, just build rapport with that adjuster. We have, you know, relationships with different insurance companies, where, I mean, our goal is to ultimately try to get the claim settled in a fair and reasonable manner for our clients. we can give suggestions on how we think or what we think should be replaced or restored. But at the end of the day, it's really up to the adjuster. They approve or deny what we recommend. So we really try to make it a partnership, collaborate, and ultimately share the whys we think, you know, certain repairs need to take place in our clients' homes.
Let's go to Linda in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hi. I will make this fast. I just wanted to tell the two sisters I watched their show, and I just had John's Appliance here to check the tubes in my washer because I was worried after hearing from them about what could happen. And the washer tubes are excellent and in great shape. So two sisters from Minneapolis, St. Paul, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Oh, I love that, Linda. Thank you so much for calling in. And that must, Kirsten, make you feel so good to hear that.
Oh, Linda, I am smiling so big over here. That is exactly why we do what we do. And we've been so proud to have this show to, show homeowners, you know, these tips and tricks that they can do at their home. So I'm so glad that you called someone in, and I'm even more happy that all of your connections and washer lines are all good to go.
Oh, this was so much fun. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We're so happy to be able to support Wisconsin Public Radio.
Lindsay Brinkman-Uzelding and Kirsten Brinkman-Meehan, they're sisters. They're co-starring in the new HGTV series, Renovation 911. 8-episode season underway, focused on their emergency renovation business based in Minneapolis. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.